You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you may think you bought a piece of technology, from a phone to major farm equipment, but in some ways you may be renting it. Find out how companies limit the ability to get their products repaired and sometimes charge subscription fees for you to continue using the stuff you bought. Now, the state's largest business association has threatened to sue the Department of Natural Resources over a proposed rule to tighten regulations on surface water pollution. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce says the rule as is would exceed spending permitted under state law by more than $50 million. The DNR says the rule, which will be revised before the September deadline, will cost much less, just $2.5 million over 2 years. We're talking about potential changes to water pollution regulations in Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on how Wisconsin laws work when it comes to water pollution? Do you want to see more regulation or less? Do you have concerns over how tighter regulations might affect your own business? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave Strifling is the director of the Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, great to be with you. Thanks for having me again.
Can you walk us through what these new limits, these new regulations from the DNR would look like?
So there are a number of programs under the Clean Water Act that DNR has to follow. This is one specific category called the Anti-Degradation Program. And what the policy does is just what the name implies. It applies to the waters that are doing well, the waters that are in good condition, meeting water quality standards. And it tries to prevent them from degradation, to protect them from worsening water quality caused by new or increased discharges. So this is an existing program that DNR is just updating. It's not a new program, but there are some new requirements here, and that's what WMC is objecting to.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about those new requirements?
Sure. So, you know, there's disagreement here, obviously, about exactly what is happening. But DNR, from its perspective, is just updating the anti-degradation program to reflect federal requirements that were enacted in 2015. It's defining what it means by high quality waters. It can do that on a water body based standard or on a parameter based standard. So it could say, for example, this is a high quality water for phosphorus. This is a high quality water for chloride, so on and so forth. It would also allow a cumulative impacts analysis that would consider multiple discharges to the same body of water. And it's also adding specifics about how DNR determines when a new discharge or an increased discharge would significantly lower water quality. There's a percentage basis of the water's assimilative capacity that's at issue here. It's going from a 33% reduction, tightening that up to a 10% reduction in water quality. So those are all areas of dispute between the two sides.
Yeah, and the DNR says, okay, we think it has this much economic impact. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce comes up with a much higher number. What's going into those dueling readouts of the costs of this?
Yeah, so I'm not an economist, but here's how I read it. DNR's estimate says that this is going to have an impact of about $2 million over 2 years. So from DNR's perspective, that's not altogether significant. WMC's estimate is over $50 million. So WMC is estimating that DNR has vastly underestimated the cost of this revision to the anti-degradation program. And it comes down to WMC's claim that DNR has both underestimated the number of permittees and underestimated the cost per permittee that this program will affect. And there's a lot of specifics in WMC's comments that we probably don't have time to get into the weeds on, but you could look at things like the treatment that's required, the delay in projects, the impact of a second discharge, a new discharge by the same permittee. All of those are feeding into that $50-plus million estimate. And it's really significant because if the cost of the regulation is over $10 million over a two-year period, the agency needs legislative authorization, in effect, a law passed by the legislature that would authorize it to issue the rule, and that has not happened. So if a court were to determine that the cost of this is over $10 million, the rule could not go into effect under current Wisconsin law.
Talking to Dave Strifling with Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative, looking at DNR changes to pollution regulations for bodies of water in the state, possible legal lawsuit or legislative action on it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Dave, this would apply to a variety of industries and economic groups. Some of the groups raising concerns are in agriculture, some of the larger scale dairy operations. What could this mean for them?
Well, there's some dispute about whether CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, are covered under the rule. So if those are swept in, that would obviously have significant implications for them. There's also stormwater discharges that are covered under the rule, if not covered under a general permit that WDNR has issued. So that would have significant implications for the agricultural industry as well. One thing to realize here, though, is this is just a proposed rule. Mm-hmm. This is not a final rule yet. WDNR still has to go back and consider all the comments it has received before it even issues a final rule to the Natural Resources Board for approval. It says it's thinking about doing that in September. So we've still got some time to see how all this is going to play out.
There's a lot of legal nuance here, obviously, Dave. What ultimately is at stake? How big a difference are these distinctions among parties here going to make when it comes to the actual quality of these lakes and streams we're talking about?
Well, I think it could be significant, especially when we're talking about those higher quality waters, outstanding resource waters, exceptional resource waters, and really any waterway that's meeting water quality standards, that's meeting the designated uses that the state has laid out, whether that be fishable, swimmable, drinkable, you name it. All of those could come under fire here if this rule does not go into effect. And, you know, WMC's threat of litigation is one thing, but what also will come into play here is what Republican legislators think about the rule. And that's important because under some recent changes to Wisconsin law, there's a legislative committee called the Joint Committee on the Review of Administrative Rules that can essentially put the rule on indefinite hold. And so it's not just WMC that we have to be thinking about here. It's also the Wisconsin legislature that could impact the progress of this rule.
We're talking to Dave Strifling, director of Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative, looking at new water pollution regulations proposed by the DNR that have been criticized by some in the business community. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think new water regulations should apply to the CAFOs, these larger livestock operations? Are you concerned about these proposed DNR rules? Have you been following this? Is this an important issue in your community, in your local lake or river? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Dave Strifling, director of Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative, looking at water pollution in Wisconsin, some new rules proposed by the DNR that have been challenged by business groups. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your biggest concerns when it comes to clean water and water regulations here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Brian is with us in Rice Lake. Brian, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
What are departees and what is the Verdilla something that they
the
using?
Degradation, I think you're looking for, Brian. Can you talk, Dave, about what we mean degradation that's at the center of this DNR proposed policy?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're looking at those high quality waters that meet water quality standards. There are separate programs under the Clean Water Act to address the waters that aren't doing so well. This one has to do with trying to protect the waters that are meeting water quality standards. And so one of the big issues here is yeah, what does it mean to have a significant lowering of water quality in those high quality waters? Should it be 10%? Should it be 33%? Courts have come down at a number of different places, and the EPA does not specify exactly where that bar should fall in terms of exactly what it means to be significant. So that's part of the issue here that DNR is trying to address in the rule.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Now, talking about courts and the Clean Water Act, well, the U.S. Supreme Court issued an important ruling that, in effect, rolls back some of the Clean Water Act, at least on certain kinds of water. Dave, what happened there?
Yeah, so this is an area concerning wetlands and the federal government's jurisdiction over wetlands. In other words, when do you need a federal permit to fill a wetland on your property for development because you want to build a home or build a shopping mall or whatever the case may be? And the court sharply limited federal jurisdiction over wetlands as compared to a pretty longstanding interpretation of its precedent. And so what that does is throw the onus onto states to try to protect wetlands within their boundaries. And states are all across the board on what they've done on that score. And so ultimately what I think the immediate position is that many less wetlands are protected under federal law. And we know now that wetlands aren't just swamps. They're not wastelands to be filled. They're actually really important ecologically for a number of reasons, from storm surge buffers to pollutant filtration to habitat for wildlife to interchange between groundwater and surface water. Lots of important ecosystem services that they fulfill. So this is an important decision.
The argument, I think, was that, okay, if you have smaller wetlands, maybe ephemeral is the word sometimes used, they come and go over time, they're not directly connected to streams and rivers and things like that, then the Clean Water Act just didn't apply to them. It shouldn't, the argument was, I think, have applied to them in the first place. How big a part of the story is that?
Yeah, that's a big part of the story. And I think what we've got happening here is a little bit of a disconnect between the law and the science. The scientists would say, and I think, again, I'm not a scientist, but my understanding is that almost all water is connected, whether it's groundwater or surface water, it's all part of the same water cycle, especially if it's nearby. What the Supreme Court said in the decision is, to be jurisdictional under federal law, we need a surface connection, not just a groundwater connection between a wetland and a traditional water of the United States, like a river or a stream or a lake. If we don't have that, if you can't go out into your backyard and see a continuous surface connection between the wetland and the traditional water, we're going to say there's no federal jurisdiction, because we just think that your average person doesn't have the ability or maybe the financial means to test whether there's a groundwater connection, which had been part of the previous test.
Oh, briefly, what does this mean for Wisconsin? What is our level of wetland protection compared to what just changed under federal law?
Wisconsin has done more than most states. You do need a permit generally for discharge into wetlands in Wisconsin. However, in 2017, the legislature acted to exempt some wetlands from that rule. And they're the smaller ones, 3 acres or less in size in rural areas, 1 acre or less in size in urban areas. That category of wetlands now is more likely to be completely unregulated under the Clean Water Act.
Let's bring on another caller now. Todd is with us in De Pere. Todd, hi.
Hi. Just a comment on CAFOs and residential non-point pollution. I fish Lake Winnebago, and every year in the summer, I can see that lake. It's terrible. It's disgusting. The algae blooms, and it's not just the CAFOs. I'm sure it's lawn fertilizers, non-point pollution, but the CAFOs, I live in a rural area. I see them dumping semi-loads after semi-loads of raw sewage next to runoff creeks and areas. It's just getting to Lake Winnebago. They have to be held accountable.
Todd, thanks for the call. Dave, what is the state of the art of regulating that kind of manure disposal and non-point pollution that finds its way into, say, Lake Winnebago?
Yeah, non-point source pollution is really tough. Not typically not regulated under the Clean Water Act. Wisconsin has done something to regulate it via its stormwater regulations. But I think what the caller is really talking about is an enforcement question. You know, if it's being done in violation of a permit that a CAFO has, that's not a really a legal question. That's an enforcement question for DNR.
Thanks for the call, Todd. And Dave, yeah, as I understand it, if I open a CAFO and get a permit for it, I have to have some kind of manure management plan, right?
Correct. That is correct.
Again, Todd, thanks for the call. Dave, as you mentioned, the DNR rule we started off talking about here, it is a proposal. It's got a while to go. What kind of things are you watching for that could potentially change over the next couple few months?
Well, the big thing is going to be what DNR does with that cost estimate, because it already received some of WMC's comments on its preliminary fiscal estimate, and it bumped the cost up a little bit, less than $1 million, though. So it's still well beneath that $10 million threshold. And that's going to be, I think, the key point of dispute between the parties, because WMC is obviously reading the rule to include many more requirements than perhaps WDNR is, and is estimating the cost differently as a result. So, you know, it's going to be a question of where that final cost ends up, and then, of course, what the Wisconsin legislature does, if it allows this rule to proceed or if it hangs it up in the Joint Committee on the Review of Administrative Rules. Both of those are items to watch, I think.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks. My pleasure.
That's Dave Strifling, director of Marquette Law School's Water, Law, and Policy Initiative. He talked to us about proposed pollution regulations here in the state and a potential legal challenge down the road. Plus, we took a quick look at that U.S. Supreme Court ruling putting some limits on the Clean Water Act when it comes to wetlands around the country. Now, childcare in Wisconsin is expensive and it's hard to find. At the same time, childcare providers are one of the lowest paid kinds of workers in the state. Now, temporary federal pandemic aid for childcare providers is ending. Corrine Hess reports that workers and families could face some difficult choices.
When Diana Wells found out she was pregnant in 2018, she started searching for reliable childcare. And then she heard horror stories about potential providers in the Madison area being understaffed and unexpectedly shutting down.
And the cost was incredible.
Wells told her story at an event in New Glarus. While pregnant, she joined a year-long waiting list to get into Corrine's Little Explorers, which is owned by her sister-in-law, Corrine Hendrickson. But it's an hour drive from Wells' home in Verona. Now, her 4-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter are at Corrine's Little Explorers. She says her children are thriving, but to make it work, Wells had to cut back her hours as a teacher in the Verona Area School District.
2 hours of my day is spent in the car when I can't be prepping for my lessons, I can't be grading.
Her story is not unusual. Childcare in Wisconsin is expensive and hard to find. A report from the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association found over half of the state is in a childcare desert. A separate report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum found the average two-income household in Wisconsin spends 17% of their income on care for one child. For the last 3 years, Wisconsin childcare providers have been buoyed by a federal pandemic relief program that helped them improve pay for their employees while keeping tuition costs for families down. In June, funding for that program, called Child Care Counts, will be cut in half. Democratic Governor Tony Evers included $340 million in his state budget proposal to stabilize the program. So far, that funding remains intact, but it's seen as at risk as Republicans rewrite the budget. And preserving that funding is the subject of a statewide campaign among childcare professionals and advocates. Sean Fedaplace is with Main Street Alliance, a liberal trade group for small businesses. He says the future of childcare counts affects everyone.
If we don't get at least a good amount of funding to that program, I think you're going to see max exodus of staff. And you're also going to see huge rate increases for parents, too. And I don't think that gets fully appreciated yet, just like how devastating this would be.
Even as the cost of childcare has risen, childcare providers themselves often struggle to earn a living wage. The average pay for the profession is between $7 and $12 an hour. making it one of the lowest paid occupations in the state, according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum. But there's also a limit to how much providers can charge parents. Some families already decide to have a parent leave the workforce rather than pay the high cost of daily care. State data shows about 4,900 child care providers across the state received an average of $116,000 each through the Child Care Counts program. An October survey of Wisconsin providers found 60% will have to increase tuition when the program expires. Back at the Nuglaris event, Wanda Legler says she spent her career in the child care industry because it suits her. But at age 70, Legler says she's fed up that the government hasn't done more to improve wages. She thinks it's because some legislators don't support careers for women.
A lot of these people making the decisions, they honestly feel that we should just be home, taking care of our kids. And I've seen it and I've bumped into it over and over and over again.
After several hours, the event wraps up with parents feeling grateful and providers hopeful. And right now, Diana Wells has figured out what works best for her family. But she's already starting to worry about next year, when her son starts kindergarten in Verona and her daughter is an hour away at a Nuclearis daycare. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, we were just talking about a big water quality issue here in Wisconsin. On a related note, another big issue here in the state, algae blooms. What causes them and the impact they can have on our lakes and streams and the ecosystems that surround them and our use of them, plus a look at invasive species in Wisconsin waterways. Then find out why Finland is the happiest country on the planet, at least according to one measure of happiness, and what we might learn from that country. You could join in both of those conversations, and you could join in right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. Give us a report on your local waterway, your lake or stream. Are you seeing these algae blooms more and more over the years? Are you seeing them already just after we kicked off a June in your local lake? What do you think is the cause? What questions do you have about causes and possible solutions? Email ideas@wpr.org, then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we talked about great places to go for a hike here in Wisconsin. You shared some of your favorites, and we heard from some more of you online. Rose on the Ideas Network Facebook page writes, "Just listening to Central Time talking about hikes in Wisconsin, enjoying the conversation. We're segment hiking the Ice Age Trail and really like the short Tish Mills segment. It has a water crossing at a creek. It was oh so refreshing after hiking 8 miles that day." David emails, "My favorite hike is Tower Hill State Park in Spring Green, because when you get to the top at the tower, it has a little museum about the history of mining in the area and the former town of Helena, Wisconsin." And on Facebook, Mark sums up the consensus: Wisconsin has some of the best hiking trails in the Midwest. Keep sharing your favorite hikes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stay hydrated if you're hiking this weekend. It's going to be pretty warm in most of the state. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, 1A's Record Club pays tribute to Tina Turner. They've been overwhelmed, they say, with listener responses. They'll share what people have to say about the musical legend. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, when you buy a product, a phone, a computer printer, a car, a coffee maker, piece of farm equipment, do you own it? Easy question, right? Of course you own it. You bought it. But our next guest says, wait, not so easy. If you crack the screen on the phone, can you repair it yourself or take it to any shop? Some manufacturers might stop certain features on your phone if you do. Same goes for expensive combines and tractors on farms. And more manufacturers are creating subscription fees to use features on your product. Some car companies, for example, have fees to use your seat warmer or enhanced acceleration features, again, on the car you bought. Printers get mad at you if you try to use third-party ink cartridges. Our next guest says we're seeing ownership rights chipped away, but we can do something about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you run into this? Have you tried to repair something or get something repaired, but found out that you could void a warranty or even end up with an unusable product? Have you bought something and then had to pay a regular fee to keep using some features on it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nathan Proctor is Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG, the Public Interest Research Group. Nathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Now, I've heard about the repair issues, and we'll talk about the right to repair concept in a bit. But this new piece you wrote, we've got it linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Something a little different here. How are companies finding ways to get people to keep paying to use features of products they already bought?
Yeah, it's something that is kind of at the heart of the Right to Repair campaign, is this premise that you bought it, you own it, you should be able to use it however you want. But because the products that we use now are dependent on software and the internet, there's just all kinds of opportunities for the manufacturer to code them in such a way, or to control them through the internet in such a way, where they get to tell you what to do with the product. And a lot of times they're using that control to get you to buy more things from the company, more services, you know, upgrades. I mean, people know the printer ink, for example, you know, that if you want to get the printer ink that's made by the company, it's a lot more expensive than the alternatives. But the alternatives, it's very difficult to get them to work. And that's because of the software restrictions that are put inside the printer that just make it hard for the you know, aftermarket companies to supply compatible cartridges. And this is happening. It's going to happen more and more, especially with the internet, because that gives companies the ability to you know, change the terms of use remotely, to try to continually, you know, hassle you to get you to buy more stuff from them. And that's wrong.
I shared one of the examples from the piece you wrote. I had not heard of this. A couple of car companies are saying, yeah, your car comes with a seat warmer, and if you subscribe and pay money, you can use the seat warmer and some other features. What is going on in cars?
Well, I mean, the companies that make these cars are being basically pushed to find ways to get more monthly revenue out of the car. And it doesn't matter if it's fair or reasonable in some of these examples. It's just technologically possible. It's actually technologically trivial, right? But it's extractive and wrong. Like that same example, I mean, the first time I heard of that, I was like, well, why wouldn't you just bypass the internet and put a switch there? I mean, the seat heater is physically in the car. It's not difficult to turn something on and off. You don't need an internet connection for that feature. It'd be like if the person who made you, a contractor who built your house, charged you monthly subscription fees so that the light switches worked. I mean, we wouldn't accept that because it's ridiculous, and we shouldn't accept it in our cars either.
There's just a few examples in your piece. If I'm reading you right, your concern is this is just the early wave, and we're going to see a lot more of this kind of thing potentially in consumer products.
Yeah, I was talking with you know, a friend of mine at a child's birthday party, and he said that, you know, in his line of work, there's just these Wall Street guys, he said, come in and they just try to push you to find whatever way you can to find some way to force people to pay monthly for things. And there's so much pressure because there's so much profit margin in that kind of business operation that they're just going to, even if it doesn't make any sense, even if it drives customers crazy, there's just so much money to be made that unless we set up rules to say you're not allowed to do this, it's just going to happen more and more with more different products.
Talking to Nathan Proctor with USPIRG. He heads the Campaign for the Right to Repair there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about these ways that companies try to get you to pay for stuff monthly that you already bought from them, and the right to repair and how difficult it can be to repair things yourself or to go to a repair shop unless it's the manufacturer's repair shop. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ryan is with us in Green Bay. Ryan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
I just want to say, as somebody who's kind of been the family IT repair guy, who's been working on fixing cracked screens since Samsung Galaxy S1, that I find this whole right to repair thing absolutely critical to fighting the, you know, subscription-based model that we seem to be moving for absolutely everything. If we want to talk about vehicles, let's talk about John Deere and how they're affecting the farming equipment that's being used by farmers in our region. If we want to talk about consumer products, we can talk about Apple and their continued fight to not include USB-C standardization in the EU, even though it's been passed by law. I feel like if somebody like me, who knows how to repair things and has, you know, the will to learn how to do so, because I don't have a degree in IT or anything like that, but I can, you know, put a couple screws together and I can remove some glue, I should be able to do that for something that I already paid for, and I shouldn't be stuck behind some kind of firmware wall when it comes to some sort of software keeping me from using my device exactly how I want to. And if anybody wants to look up more of this right to repair stuff in a digestible way, please look up Lewis Rossman on YouTube. I've been following him for years now, and it's just a great resource in terms of trying to figure out what this thing is all about and how important it is to us as consumers in a capitalist society that says we should be able to own things. No, maybe not so much.
Ryan, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Nathan, Ryan, pretty fired up there. Clearly, a couple things he brought up. First of all, he's been replacing screens on his family's phones of various makes and models for years. You write that there was at least for a while an effort to say, yeah, if you start doing that, we're going to start cutting some of your functionality. What did we see there?
Yeah, so in when the iPhone 13 first came out, if you replace the screen, you know, the front-facing camera, which handles the Face ID, is connected to the screen. And if you had it repaired outside of Apple's control, basically without Apple software, it would deactivate Face ID. It would become inoperable. And so eventually Apple pushed out a firmware update that would made it possible for aftermarket, you know, shops to repair the screen. And now it just gives you a warning that, you know, ooh, this was done by somebody who was non-genuine or whatever. And I agree with the caller 100%. And you can just hear how frustrated and annoying it is to be told that you can't do something just because you're not blessed by the manufacturer. I think it's fundamentally un-American. Like, we're a nation of tinkerers and makers. Like, we're not just consumers, like, we're producers. So many of the innovations that make our lives great are things that, you know, people came up with tinkering in their garage, including these companies that are now telling us we're not smart enough to touch our own products. Like, they started in garages. And I think that they need to extend the same kind of collaborative, you know, cooperative hand to us that made their technology possible.
Ryan also brought up a key issue here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, very expensive farm equipment with proprietary software, unique tools that you might only be able to get at a manufacturer-approved shop. What are we seeing there, Nathan?
Well, first of all, I mean, I would say that for both, you know, these consumer products and farm equipment, we've now won state laws which mandate that the companies like Apple and John Deere have to share the materials that they use in their authorized repair shops with independent mechanics and technicians and product owners. But farm equipment is a huge, you know, leading issue on right to repair, in part because farmers are completely dependent on functional working equipment to make a living and to stay in business and to keep their farm. And when the only way to get something fixed because of an intentional technological lock on the equipment that makes it so you have to use certain software tools to get it working again, and the dealer is the only one in possession of those tools, like, that creates a huge problem for farmers. The biggest problem there is the downtime. If the equipment's not working and you need to get the, you know, the seed in the ground or get the fertilizer down or harvest the crop before a big storm, you're not going to want to be told by the equipment dealer, oh, we can't come out today, or we can't come out till 3 weeks from now. One example from Oklahoma in a recent report that we put out, Out to Pasture, said that the dealer told me it was going to be 9 months before they could calibrate the hydraulic, you know, equipment on his equipment so that it would go back into service. 9 months, that's an entire season. That's ridiculous.
Thanks again for that call, Ryan. We're talking to Nathan Proctor from US PERG about a recent piece he wrote on the death of ownership and the ways companies get us to keep paying for things we already bought and make it hard to get our stuff repaired unless we go to the company that made it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's gotten more difficult to repair stuff? Electronics, appliances, tractors, you name it. Do you have a product where you have to use something proprietary made by that company, printer cartridges, coffee refills, you name it, just to use the product you bought? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG, the Public Interest Research Group, looking at the way companies make it harder for us to get consumer products repaired and new technologies that make us keep paying to use features on things we already bought, from phones and farm equipment, coffee makers to cars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nathan, before we go back to our callers, you mentioned some states are passing laws, including just very recently, our neighbors in Minnesota. What did we see there?
Yeah, Minnesota passed the broadest right to repair law we've seen. It mandates that manufacturers of a lot of products, although unfortunately not including farm equipment, have to share all the parts, tools, and information that they make available for their own authorized networks to fix things to the product owner and to independent shops. So starting in July of next year, it's going to be a lot easier to fix products in Minnesota, everything from, you know, dishwashers and cell phones to, you know, enterprise computing equipment and HVAC and a whole set of other products. And I think it's going to save people a lot of money. And it's going to cut electronic waste. And it's a really, really big deal.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rob is with us in Markesan. Rob, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Rob?
Microsoft. Recently, they did a deal where they did an update. And basically, all of the Office application on my computer disappeared. And finally got a hold of them on it. And took 3 weeks before they finally gave me a copy of it back, which was a different copy than what I had, so my product key didn't work. I had to spend another week to get the right flavor. But, yeah, they did it as part of an update, and it just disappeared. And it took almost a month to prove that I paid for it and that they should give it back.
Rob, thanks a lot for that call. Nathan, whether it's a computer or anything else that uses software, that software update, that's a chance for companies to do stuff that consumers like Rob aren't going to be too happy about.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly, I mean, one of the things that happens pretty frequently is a loss of features with an update. And that can be really upsetting. Like, you know, and you wonder if some of these updates are really to improve the security or the device operation or to accomplish something else. And I think, I mean, from a cybersecurity perspective, it's really scary when companies put, you know, kind of other anti-consumer updates in those update files, because we really want people to update everything to the most latest version to patch vulnerabilities that help protect the internet against cybercrime. But people are resistant to doing that because they've had these experiences where they've lost key functionality because an update had some other change in it. And I think that that's definitely something that companies need to pay a little bit more attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Bridget joins us now in Superior. Bridget, hi.
Hi. I had a situation with a air conditioner, and I called the thermal guy who put it in, and he came out and took some parts apart and left it undone. I asked him to come and put it back together. He didn't, and I kept calling about the part. Got to the point where he wouldn't return my calls. Went on, I called different companies, and by the time the next company came, left it exposed, mice had chewed it.
Oh, no.
So Yeah. So then it was then they wouldn't cover the warranty and he wouldn't return my calls.
Bridget, thanks for the call. Nathan, I don't know if this is exactly a right to repair issue, but the idea that if there's only one game in town, only the manufacturer can repair it. If that was the case in Bridget's, I don't think that probably was here. You'd have no recourse. The idea that, okay, there might be multiple places you can go to get something repaired gives us a better chance that we're going to find somebody who can do the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say, you know, your likelihood of getting a good experience with a service technician is really enhanced by competition, you know, kind of weeding the market of people who treat customers like this story we just heard. Like, hopefully we can the market will squeeze those people out, and so that companies that treat their customers well and charge them a fair rate are the only ones around.
Bridget, thanks for that call. We're talking to Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PIRG. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Racine. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment or at least ask for some commentary on the transition to software as a service or computing as a service overall, in that we're actually losing access to our computing devices and the software on them in a push for greater revenue and, you know, more pervasive and perpetual licensing of software. You used to be able to buy Microsoft Office one time and use it for a decade, and now Microsoft wants us to buy a perpetual license every year. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that as it relates to this whole topic.
Interesting, Aaron. Thanks for that. Interesting question. Nathan, what do you think? We used to buy a box of software, install it ourselves, and own it as long as we had that computer. Now it's a service, Aaron says.
Yeah, I mean, this is the blessing and the curse of the internet, right? Where software is not a static application anymore, right? Because, like, I mean, a Nintendo cartridge pretty much plays the same now as it did, you know, back in 1986. But the other games that we're playing are all dependent on the internet. And that just completely changes what we're buying when we buy software. I think that this is a big question. And I think that there, you know, as I argue in the piece that you're referencing, The Death of Ownership, you know, it, at least there's truth in advertisement when Microsoft says what you're paying for is the, you know, continual monitoring and updating of this and you pay monthly. You know, at least you know what you're getting. It's obviously different if they sell you something and you think you bought it outright, but really you just bought the first, you know, entry and now you have to pay monthly to actually use it. So they're separate issues, but I look forward to a world where there's just a lot more transparency, clarity, and options for people to have more control over the technology in our lives. And one of the problems we have an overly consolidated tech market is, you know, if people would rather just pay once and have something static and lasted exactly the way they bought it, maybe they would. But with so few options in the tech market, there's just not an incentive to create those products because everybody's looking for, you know, these monthly revenue streams. And so they're just going to push us into these systems, whether or not we actually want them.
Thanks for that call, Aaron. And Nathan, talking about transparency, somebody might think, okay, well, I won't buy a product that's going to have this hidden monthly charge to use all of its functions. Is it always that easy to tell when we're buying something that that's going to happen?
I mean, the reason why, like, we have this thing in the Uniform Commercial Code and state laws that protects consumers from unfair and deceptive practices is because you shouldn't have to walk around the Best Buy and think, which of these products is not being marketed to me deceptively to trick me into paying for some monthly thing that I don't know about. Like, we just should not have, you know, you shouldn't walk around the grocery store. Yeah, maybe some of these products that say they're potato chips are really like rat poison. You shouldn't have to worry about that. There should be just standard consumer protection that the products that are being sold are safe and usable. And I think that that's what I'm advocating for, right? If you're going to tether somebody to a secret software arrangement where you get to extract a monthly payment from them, you know, that needs to be exposed and there needs to be transparency there. And people are being, you know, kind of duped by these companies and they find themselves totally dependent on their system, which now all of a sudden is way more expensive than they thought at the outset. And I think that, you know, we should the system should protect consumers from that kind of deceptive product.
Nathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
That's Nathan Proctor with the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG. The piece we've been talking about called The Death of Ownership, we've got it linked over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, disabilities and aging don't have to kick us out of the kitchen. It's Food Friday. We'll get advice on cooking for everybody with the author of the new book, Crip Up the Kitchen. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, wages for American workers have stagnated over the last few decades. The author of a new book tells us that's the result of intentional decisions by business and political leaders from both parties. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.